get clarification, we followed up. We only have two more chair meetings.
Correct.
Okay, you had in your email, you had a third one, 14th. And that's not, the 13th is where I'm making the presentation.
Correct. I think that was an old notation, which I had that on there from when Beth and I first talked.
Okay.
And yes, well.
Right.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, council, how you doing? We're ready to start in just a few minutes, okay?
I'm good, I was delayed because traffic is so backed up, so I literally pulled over and I'm in a parking lot. So that's why you all could drive the PowerPoint. I'm happy to continue on, but I didn't make it back to my home in time to sign on for the login.
Okay, not a problem, we're gonna get started just in a few minutes.
Okay.
We have all of your information here with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It is now 4:00, and I know that y'all just really want to be here this time of day, right? thank you all for coming, and we're going to jump right into things. For those of you all that don't know me, my name is Councilwoman Jacoby Pittman, and this is my chair, Dr. Jaffe, and we are excited because this is our last meeting with you all. And I just want to just kind of recap just a little bit. Those of you all that have been with us over the last few months, you know, we have been charged with discussing the scope of affordable housing and workforce housing and what entities within public and private and nonprofit sector are addressing the issues. And what best practices or policies have other communities adopted in addressing those issues? So today, we have Councilwoman Flowers, who's out of Pinellas.
Commissioner.
And she will be sharing some of her best practices in Pinellas. And we're excited to hear about what she is doing. We are almost there. And we're not ready yet, Commissioner. This committee has been addressing the scope of our charge by President Freeman and Michael Boylan, who's with us today, and, of course, his co-chair, which is Ron Salem. We feel like we have accomplished what our charge was as a committee. And from the beginning, we've been able to bring presentations to you that discuss the impact of the housing crisis in our community in various ways with expertise, with my co-chair. And so we have some of the presentations, the expertise who are with us today. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the, I should say, actions or discussions that we've had has been in the Jacksonville Housing 2030 plan that addresses the need of housing. And that just really confirms what we have done over the last few months regarding affordable housing, the goals, objectives, and policies that is pertinent for the recommendations for an implementation plan for our targeted areas. So today, Dr. Jaffe will be sharing some information from the SWOT analysis with additional discussion and preliminary recommendations from you all, as well as the experts. But before we get to that, I'd like for Councilman Boylan to share. I know you've been to all of the meetings, right? But we're excited where we are, and thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the leadership that you and Dr. Jaffe have displayed and the great work that you guys have done here. And I want to thank all those in the room for your participation. It's really important to see us land this plane. This morning we heard from the homeless working group and some suggestions there, as well as with the access to health care this afternoon. And we all, as we all well know, these are intertwining issues. One is relevant to the other. There was some misunderstanding, I think, on the part of some. So I just want to be clear. As we go back and take a look at the charge, we were specifically charged by this committee to do just as Jacoby, Mr. Councilmember Pittman just said. You know, what's the scope of the issue? You know, what's being done, and what are some of the best practices around? And it concludes with, to borrow a phrase, and this is from the charge itself, from the Resiliency Committee's executive summary, the principal objective is to establish a reference guide for all the best practices, strategies, and lessons that were identified throughout the overall process, with an eye towards recommending policies, practices, funding, and or funding vehicles that would greatly assist citizens that are presently burdened by such critical quality of life issues. My full expectation is that through this process, Councilmember Pittman, myself, and others will take many of the recommendations that we hear from all of you in these four, three working groups and move them forward in some form or fashion, maybe not all of them, but some of them, in the format of a resolution or ordinance or appropriation, or however we characterize it to see fit, at which time, when those bills get introduced, you can go through the committee process, we can vet them. We had a really great conversation this afternoon with the access to health care. When the three or four recommendations were out there, people came up and tasked them or challenged them or had some concerns about them. And it was very helpful because that allows us, as we take a look at creating those ordinances and or resolutions, be an opportunity to make sure that we've covered all of our bases in laying them out. And so the recommendations can be sparse in some respects. If the intent of the recommendations is understood and clearly understood, we'll work out the details as we negotiate them in some respects as we go through the review process. I did want to let you know, following this meeting, although this is the last working group meeting, there will be two meetings of the co-chairs collectively. The first is going to be on November the 17th at 1 o'clock, at which point in time we'll be reviewing the first draft of the a report that's going to be assembled by the Northeast Florida Regional Council. And a great amount of work going into that, as you might well expect. There'll be a follow-up meeting on December the 7th, where we take a look at the final reading of that report, and then a full presentation to the council on December the 13th at 5 o'clock, at which point in time we will make certain we're looking to publish about 50 copies of the report. And then, obviously, it'll be available online for others to take a look at, so you don't need to carry around a significantly large document at this point in time. Again, thank you all so much for the time you put into this. I really do appreciate it. All recommendations are welcome and encouraged, and we'll see what we can do to move them forward. And again, I want to thank my two colleagues here for your support.
Thank you, Councilman Borland. So what we're going to do is just change our agenda around just a little bit. I'm going to ask Commissioner Flowers, if she would go ahead and get started, introduce herself, and tell us all of the great work that you're doing in Pinellas County.
Okay, well, thank you all so very much for allowing me to be a part of your meeting on today. I've had a chance to speak with Ms. Pittman and another team member of hers on the phone just about the overall housing crisis that I believe the entire United States is experiencing. This concern is not unique to any one community. However, some communities are having a little bit more difficulty in dealing with the nuances of the housing crisis than others. So I prepared for you some information that I think would be new information for you, and then some things for thought, and certainly am open to conversation. What I like to do is, as we go through the slides, if you have any questions or comments, I'd like for you to go ahead and present them at that time. That way you won't forget to ask at the end, and we can have a dialogue more so than just a presentation. So is that okay with everyone?
Yes, ma'am. That's fine.
Okay. So, you know, years ago, we used to always hear from our parents, at least I did. I was born in 1964, and we always heard about the American dream. And that American dream consisted of stable employment. It consisted of an education. It consisted of a strong family unit. And certainly home ownership was a large part of that. Today, the question mark for all of us right now is whether or not home ownership in America is a dream, or is it something that will remain within the grasp of so many that desire, but there are so many barriers that are preventing us. Next slide, please. So not unique to the city of St. Petersburg or Pinellas County, we are seeing a number of persons being priced out of their communities. They're being priced out of their communities for a number of reasons, but the latest statistics here in the Tampa Bay area indicates that we see a population growth increase of 20% between 2010 and 2020. As of the beginning of 2022, Pinellas County has experienced more than 3,000 per people living in a square mile radius, which is equating to over 1,000 people moving into our community per week. Next slide, please. One of the most recent studies demonstrated that in St. Petersburg alone, we saw an increase of nearly 25%, making the jump the third highest increase in the entire country. I can tell you that now that is 35%. And I pulled up a more recent, because I'm always Googling to see where we are, where our standing is. As of October, in the city of St. Pete alone, there's over 1,543 active home listings, 121 new homes that have been built in addition to those home listings. And our average median price for a home is $389,000. And that is as of October of this year. Many of you know that based on the rate of pay that we provide, even for those working in some higher paying realms, $389,000 as a starter is still out of reach for many families. The city of St. Petersburg provided a study for the community. They had several individuals come down from the Harvard Kennedy School, and they actually went throughout the community surveying individuals who are property owners, those who are seeking to sell, as well as all of the new apartment buildings that we have going up to include townhomes. It showed that half of the city's renters pay more than 30% of their income toward housing. In some instances, we are realizing that they are paying closer to 57% of their income toward housing. As a caveat, not noted here, but just sharing with you, a 900 square foot efficiency in the city of St. Petersburg will cost you $2,500. Next slide, please. So as home purchase costs begin to soar, we are seeing a continued widening of the gap between those individuals who would love to purchase a home versus the home sale prices. I will say, however, 2 weeks ago that there was an announcement that based on the increase in interest rates, there was a slowing of the home purchase market. There were a number of homes that had been on the market well over 60 days. So that is a positive indicator. However, it does not continue to answer the problem, which is how are we going to be able to provide home ownership to those individuals that are seeking that, especially based on the wages that are paid in our communities, as well as how are we going to be able to have persons continue to even afford to rent. And the third caveat would be, what about those who are homeless, including our veterans who have their incomes that will go no higher than what their Social Security or their disability will provide for. Next slide, please. There's also another tremendous role that home insurance is playing in the market. One positive thing that we heard in the news last week was that it appeared as though Citizens, which is the largest insurer in the state of Florida, would in fact be able to pay out all of its claims in Charlotte and in Lee County and some of the other surrounding counties that experience major damage to their homes and in some instances slight damage to their homes. Next slide, please. But we do know that we still have a problem with homeowners insurance. So when you're talking about, and I'm sure many of you already know this, when you're talking about the purchase of a home, you're also looking at whatever the taxes would be on that property, as well as the insurance cost. And in many cases, particularly if you live within a flood zone, you're having to also purchase flood insurance. So your insurance, in many instances, is costing you more than your actual mortgage. Senator Brandes, prior to leaving the Senate, stated that the state of Florida also has another major problem, and that is that there is one rater, one company that handles the rating of insurance companies throughout the state of Florida. And so if you receive a non-affirming rating from his organization, you're not able to do as much business in the state of Florida as you were. And in some cases, those entities are leaving the state of Florida and not writing homeownership policies here. The companies that are remaining that are writing homeownership policies are USAA, which a lot of military families take advantage of, State Farm, Erie, NJM, a company called Lemonade, Amica, Nationwide, Allstate Insurance, and Allstate Insurance had to be coached into staying in the community by legislators saying, if you're not going to write homeowners insurance policies, we will not allow you to also write auto insurance policies. At one point, Allstate had one of their largest footprints right here in Pinellas County in the area that we call the Carillon Center. However, they have since relocated out of Pinellas County. Next slide, please. So Citizens Insurance is the major carrier in Florida. They receive a lot of their financial support and backing from the state of Florida. However, our budgets will not be able to continue that. Any home that is over 50 years of age is basically left with Citizens and not having other options. We have a lot of homes here in Pinellas County that are over 50 years of age. Some of the required upgrades to older homes can in fact be a financial barrier, particularly for our seniors. We've seen a number of companies, unfortunately, going around suggesting that the homeowner needs a new roof when in fact they do not. And so the litigation in a number of those cases have caused insurance rates to hike. We also know that within the state of Florida, we still have a number of homes that do not have their roofs up to code. It has been determined that your roof should at least be switched out every 10 years. We know that a number of families cannot afford that. And so when they're having their home inspection, in order for them to be able to continue with their homeowner's insurance, they're not passing those inspections. We also have, unfortunately, in some of our more rural parts of Pinellas County, an issue with stormwater sewer services. So many of our residents, because of the age of the home and the size of the property and the date in which those properties will acquire, they still have septic tanks. Pinellas County has taken on an initiative to go throughout Pinellas County and to actually note which areas still have a high trend of septic tanks. We have found that in our Oldsmar, Palm Harbor, and Eastlake area, we have well over 15,000 septic tanks, many of which do not meet code. So we in Pinellas County have created a program by which we will provide half of the funding up to $10,000 in order to switch individuals from septic to stormwater sewer. In some instances where there are new home builds, or new multifamily builds, we are making sure that those developers are taking care of removing that septic and going to stormwater sewer services, connecting either with the county or their local municipality. Our most recent case with Hurricane Ivan that we saw just recently, and now we have some storms that are coming up the coast that are going to reach us in a few more days, we certainly see that citizens will not be bankrupt, but they are certainly on the brink. And so the governor has requested a special session for the legislature to talk about what they can do to try to shore up citizens, because if citizens goes under, that means a lot of individuals in the state of Florida will be without insurance. And if you have a mortgage on your home, or if you've taken out equity in your home, you are required to have insurance on your property. Next slide, please. So Pinellas County has done something that I'm very proud of, something that I was able to bring over from serving as a city council member in the city of St. Pete, and that is looking at our housing support services and how we can marry dollars with other programs, other grant funding, and partnering with municipalities that are not in our unincorporated areas so that we can best assist our residents. The first was the emergency rental assistance. We were very excited about receiving those dollars from the federal government, and we put every single dollar to use. In some instances, we ended up paying the back rent for individuals because they got behind as a result of COVID, and we were able to take care of their first, last, and security at their new location dwelling such that their credit would not be messed up, and they would be able to have a place that they could afford to live in. We expended every single one of those dollars. We did not have any money left over. We also established a mortgage rental assistance. We utilized some of the dollars that were sent down by the federal government, but we also set aside pots of money from our reserve area because a lot of support was going forward for those who rent, but not very much for those who owned. And we wanted to make sure that those persons would be able to maintain their homes, because once they became homeless, their situation exacerbated itself. Our first-time homebuyer assistance program is continuing to take off. We partner with St. Pete Housing Neighborhood Services, the City of St. Petersburg Greenhouse Program. We partner with Bank of America, as well as Achieva Credit Union and several others. They're continuing to provide those first-time homebuyer courses so that those individuals know exactly what they need to do, what they need to prepare for, and how to take the best advantage of the programs that are in place to aid them in purchasing their first home. Living space for students attending the University of South Florida St. Petersburg campus and the St. Petersburg College campus. And now we need to add into that our first time and home, first responder programs, first responder employees. I do apologize. I have a meeting set up with Senator Roussan. I was very excited about this, and I shared this with Ms. Pittman. I have a meeting set up with Senator Roussan, the superintendent of schools, Mr. Kevin Hendricks here, and the chancellor for the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg campus, along with the president of St. Petersburg College, Dr. Tanja Williams. In the case of USF St. Pete, they were not able to hire five of their professors coming in as merit professors and research professors because they could not afford to live here or any place close, which would have been Pasco, Polk, or Hillsborough County. As a result of that, a snowballing effect occurred, which was that they could not continue to have certain courses because those professors were no longer available to provide those course studies. And so I'll be meeting with them to talk about how we can engage the developers that have raised their hands here in our community. They've built 100% affordable, 60, 80, and 120% AMI, and how we can partner with those entities in providing partial funding, whether it's if the Pinellas County school system has recruited a new teacher. And so in order to get them here, they may pay some of their moving costs. Those moving costs would be first, last, and security into a place to stay. The same with the University of South Florida, St. Pete, building a multifamily structure on one of the properties that they own so that their professors would be able to move in. And when they leave, new professors would be able to take their place. Much like what you see in the military when they have military housing for their families. All of those partners are very, very interested in joining us. Blue Sky Communities is one of the affordable developers that will also be at the table to talk with all of us about how they could partner and make that happen. We utilized our ARPA fundings to the fullest extent. We shared some of our ARPA funding with the City of St. Petersburg, $18 million to be exact, because the City of St. Petersburg ran out of money when they began instituting their programs to help those who needed transitional housing or needed permanent housing. Our community development block grant funding continues to put an emphasis on small minority and women-owned businesses, as well as the construction and development of housing programs. Within the county and within our CDBG programming, we're looking at tiny homes. We've built several in the community. I'm very proud of them. One is right down the street from me, maybe three blocks. A veteran who's in the Marines actually moved in there. We had a ribbon cutting ceremony and it was absolutely wonderful. I'm now working with another young lady who just retired from the Navy. She has purchased some property. She's going to build a tiny home community on that property. And I'm looking forward to when we can move in those veterans in those tiny home communities. We also work with Habitat for Humanity. Habitat typically does single family homes, but they won a bid and was provided the land in St. Petersburg right off of 18th Avenue South that gives them the acreage to put in 47 townhome units. That is a new concept for us here because we typically don't do townhomes in the heart of South St. Petersburg. Funding being more cost effective, certainly more affordable for some of our younger families, especially our teachers, our police officers who are new on the force, our firefighters who are new on the force, our ambulance and EMT service providers. We're partnering also with CDC Tampa Bay Community Development Corps. An African-American gentleman is over that. He and his mother actually started it, and it's the Cooney family. They built a number of homes in Hillsborough, and I'm having them just duplicate and replicate their program over here in St. Petersburg and Pinellas County. They've also introduced me to a new format where it is, I'm going to call it computerized building of homes. It saves time. The computer is fed the architectural design drawings, and from those architectural design drawings, they can build the outer walls, build them more quickly, rather than using manpower. But then manpower is bought in for the plumbing, for all of the electrical wiring, and anything else of that nature. As I said, Blue Sky Communities is just one of the organizations that we're working with, but we do try with all of our might to utilize small minority and women-owned businesses in everything that we do. They have to be appropriately certified, they have to be licensed, they have to carry the right type of insurance, both for their workers' comp and their medical insurance for their employees. But we wanna make sure that we're opening up that vault and giving everyone an opportunity to take advantage of construction trades, but also to build homes so that they're affordable and we can really begin to put a dent in some of the issues that we've seen within our communities. Next slide, please. So what's on the horizon? We've got to work out the homeowners insurance situation, and it's not going to be just the state. It's going to take a strong investment from the homeowner insurance companies, as well as local and municipal governments to see what we can do to try to help buy down that cost of insurance. Out-of-town developers, they have to be willing to work with us. We put things in place with Expedia Contract Review, Construction Reviews, Expedia Services within our permitting departments for any development that is affordable or workforce housing. We've also gone now to being able to review plans electronically and virtually so that the developers don't have to spend time coming to our offices, waiting in line, and having half of their day be taken up so they can submit those plan reviews online. They can get their comments back from our inspectors online. If they're red tagged, they can go out and fix it and submit those reviews and those changes online. So that really helps with cost because time is money. And so anytime that you're helping a project continue to move forward, rather than spend time on the phone or coming to our offices in Clearwater and then driving on the other side of the coast, that helps. We've also devised some different training caveats because our building codes and things here in Pinellas County may be very different than the building codes in Chicago or in Louisiana or Missouri or Mississippi. And so we want to make sure that they understand what our building codes are before they engage, because if they engage and they're improper, we will red tag them and stop all construction until they fix the problem. I provided Ms. Pittman with a copy of something that we just passed here in Pinellas County. It is not a rent control agreement that's unlawful according to the state legislature, but it is something that we were able to put in place that looks at the standards that apartment leaseholders have to abide by, as well as landlords, single family homeowner landlords, and then the responsibility that lies with the tenant. There's a requirement for the time that needs to be given by which to have that tenant move out. I understand capitalism. I'm not trying to stop anyone from selling their property if that's what they want to do. But it's a little disingenuous to give someone 2 weeks to move out of a property because someone wants to purchase it. So we came up with not a tenant's rights agreement, but a tenant's bill of rights is what we called it. We had conversations and buy-in from the apartment builders association. We had buy-in from private developers. We had buy-in from the housing authorities, and we had persons from the community who found themselves in some rather sticky situations. And we crafted language, had, of course, a public hearing, and everybody didn't get everything that they wanted, but we came up with a document that we feel is solid. We came up with a document that we feel would be able to withstand any type of litigation. And we're going to get a report back in 6 months to see where we are, how many issues, concerns, complaints have we had, or how many wonderful things have happened with this. And we will consider making any tweaks to that tenant's bill of rights at that point in time, if any need to be made. We're working with investment property owners, encouraging them to go ahead and allow affordable building on those properties. We do know that they may not get as much money for that property as they desire, but it will aid us in knocking down the number of people who are working poor, who get up and go to work every day, who may be making $12 to $15 an hour, but they're still not making enough to be able to pay their bills. We already talked about the tiny home situation, and I will share with you that we have an organization here called PERC, Pinellas Ex-Offender Rehabilitation Program. A gentleman by the name of Mike Gelazzo runs that program. And a lot of entities provide funding to PERC so that those persons that are coming through the system, they're returning citizens, they're trying to get their lives back together, they're interested in a trade, whether it's welding, cabinetry, plumbing, HVAC system, masonry, whatever it is. They're interested in getting their certification and some moving on to apprenticeships in that trade. We have raised the dollars to send them to Pinellas Technical College. They've attended and received their certification, and PERC right now is one of our major tiny home builders because we're utilizing the young men that went through their program. So I'm really excited about that. It's giving them an opportunity to earn a living where they can take care of themselves and or their families, and they're not recidivating, going back to whatever it was that got them into prison in the first place. They're now able to be gainful citizens of our communities. And of course, prefab homes. Prefab homes allow you to go ahead and put those walls up very quickly. It cuts down on the construction and development of a home by 6 to 10 months. So that also cuts down on the cost of construction of a home. And so we're doing really well in those areas. And we look to continue doing more. Next slide, please. So there are several housing options. The tiny homes, we've talked about them. You all probably have seen the ads where Home Depot and even Amazon is now selling tiny homes. And some of them aren't so tiny. Amazon just had one that went up for $50,000 here in our community. And when I went by there, it is a very decent looking place. But still, when you're ordering those homes from those vendors, you still have to get someone to actually put it together for you. And you still have to get the necessary permits. Supplemental housing options, co-sharing. A lot of families are doing this. Single moms, they cannot afford to live individually, but they're getting apartments jointly, raising their children, sharing the time that they watch the children so each one can work. And that seems to be working for some people. Smaller size units, instead of building 2,000, 3,000 square foot homes, going down to smaller footprints of 900 to 1,250. That helps with the cost of construction. And some people are finding that they can live in a much smaller space. I can tell you I'm not one of those people. My clothes, my purses, and my shoes alone would takes up many closets in my house. Efficiency, garage apartments, granny units. Some people call them accessory dwelling units, but we've really done well with those. Many municipalities in Pinellas County, over 27 municipalities, have all adopted the accessory dwelling unit component. So that allows someone who may have some additional property on the back of their home to build 1 to 2 units. They're renting those units out. That's affordable, and that helps them with their mortgage payments. Some people are using them because their children have to come back and move into those because they're not able to afford to get a place of their own as soon as they graduate from college. And then just a decrease in the lot size requirements. Older homes have larger yards, both front and back. So we've moved some of those requirements in permitting so that your garages can be closer to the easement and flush sometimes with the very front of your house so that you're maximizing the space that you have. Many developers are looking at going up 2 and 3 stories for homes versus out because our contiguous land uses along certain areas will not allow them to build out, but will allow them to build up. So just trying to be as creative as we can with our housing options so that we are still providing affordable housing, but we're giving them quality housing. Next slide, please. These are some examples of the tiny homes that you can purchase from Amazon. These range in price, but they are affordable. The one to your left where the bicycle is, to order that particular one, it's $19,780. And it was about $20,000 for all the plumbing, the electrical, and all of that to add it in. So you can tell or you can see how affordable that is for someone who doesn't require a large size footprint for a home. Next slide, please. So the solutions are varied. There's not one solution. There's no one size fits all. And I don't believe that we're going to get ourselves out of this in the next 3 to 5 years because we did not come to this place in a short period of time. So a freeze on rental rates, that's going to be very difficult to do because if you are inhibiting someone's ability to earn a living, that gets you into legal waters. But there may be some ways around it with some language we'll see. But I don't believe there's an appetite within the state legislature to take that one on. Tax incentives for those renting affordable, again, the 60, 80% AMI. We're trying to do everything we can to work with developers. We have had developers who have not asked for any incentives. They've come in, they've built affordable, we're good, and their units are filling up very quickly. Just recently, we have a place that's called Skyway Lofts. There are 147 units. They are one and two bedrooms. The rent averages $900 there. It's persons that are mixed. So there's some sanitation workers that work there. There's some people with Section 8 vouchers that work there. But you don't know who is who because it's all mixed in there. The reason they were able to make that work is because the county has our Pinnacle Pinellas program where we ask the residents, will you tax yourselves an additional penny? And we will make sure that those dollars go towards affordable housing, small business development, and education. The taxpayers approved that referendum. As a matter of fact, it'll be coming up again, I believe in 2025, but it has been approved by the voters every single time with well over 80% of the vote, which is pretty good. This past year, when we had that tax incentive and were able to capture those dollars, we captured over $481 million. Of that, we dedicated $81 million for affordable. So persons who want to build affordable, we allow them to access that money. It's not the whole $80 million. It's based on the square footage of the number of units that they have that will be affordable. In the case of Skyway Homes, they qualified for $700,000. That's what it costs almost for them to purchase the land. So they were able to buy the land with our dollars. That way they only were out of pocket for the actual construction costs. And that's how they were able to make that entire project, all 147 units, affordable. We have seven additional projects coming on board, as well as a 61-unit project that will be built for seniors only by the St. Petersburg Housing Authority. And again, they accessed our dollars to help buy down the cost for construction. I've already shared with you about the partnership with developers and institutions for USF St. Pete, Pinellas County Schools, our first responders, excuse me, on helping them to be able to provide housing for their employees. The Housing and Urban Development is reconfiguring their voucher program on the federal level. I have been in constant contact with Alan Williams, who is the deputy director for HUD. And so, you know, if you aren't already in tune, just be on the lookout for the changes in their voucher programs. Our desire is that those vouchers will increase so that it aids with portability and they will be able to purchase or rent a place that is affordable based on what market rate is requiring. An increase in townhome developments because you get more units out of that. And again, garage and granny units. Next slide, please. So the faces of the new homeless are these. So many people always look at the homeless as the person who's on the corner, who may be living outside, and who asks you for change or get them something to eat. But these are the faces of the new homeless. They are our graduates from college. They're our nurses and those in occupational therapies. They're our teachers, our military, serving in the military and coming home. It's our families, our new families. And it's also those who serve and protect our communities, which are our police. And so we've got to find a way to make sure that we're providing affordable workforce housing that is sustainable, that is affordable, and that is of good quality so that everyone has, in fact, the dream that we call the American dream. Next slide, please. So the question then we're left with is to rent or to buy. That's the question of the day. It's based on what persons can afford and what resources are out there. But it's my job as a county commissioner and all other electeds' job. It's our job to not fuss and fight and argue, but to try to pool our resources so that we are making an impact in our communities. Next slide, please. If you want to visit the Pinellas County website and see some of the additional programs that we've been able to put in place, as well as some developments that we have, please feel free to visit our website. I put the links here for you. It is a very, very interesting site filled with all kinds of tips and trends and other ideas that I've not gone over for today. I try to keep that site fresh with staff's support so that all of the latest trends are placed there, to include a new group called Divvy, D-I-V-Y. Divvy is really a lease to own, if you will. If you are not able to buy your home right now, but that is the venture where you want to go, you can lease that home from Divvy, and they will take a percentage of the rent that you've been paying and put that towards your down payment and closing costs for purchasing that home. And if you decide not to purchase that home and you want to walk away, that's fine. But that's just one of the other programs that have become creative in what they're doing. Next slide, please. That's it. Any questions?
Yes. Commissioner, we have about 75 people that are here. And Ms. Chester, I think you had your hand up first. So would you come up to the microphone so Commissioner Flowers could hear you? Yeah, take your mask off and introduce yourself.
My name is Taka Chester with Changing Homelessness and Family Promise, Jacksonville. I had a question about the slide that you were talking about between the AMI 60% to 80% to 100%.
Yes, ma'am.
Is everything that you guys are doing geared to just that group of people? Because everyone that I house is 50 below and between 30 and 50. So they're never even going to get to the minimum of your 60%.
Most of the programs that are 30% AMI to the 50, 30, 40, 50, or 60 and below, many of them fall within the housing authority's realm, which is where HUD comes in at. And so I'm not trying to step on their toes as well. And it is more difficult to get units, to get developers to build that will be for those individuals with 30 or 40% AMI, because the majority of those persons will have vouchers, if not all of them will have vouchers. And that's why I said in my very last slide that we're working with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, because the amount that they provide in those vouchers for persons who are 30 and 40% AMI, and even some that are 60% AMI, the amount that they're providing in those vouchers is not keeping up with current market rates. So you can't even find a place. And many of the housing authorities, some of them are downsized. The one here in St. Petersburg used to be well over 600 units. It's down to 347 units. They have instituted a program that aids individuals who want to buy a home that's within the housing authority realm, where it veers you towards home ownership. And so when you're purchasing that home, and we have about three people that have taken advantage of that, it's rarely, fairly new here, but we have about three people in St. Pete who've taken advantage of that, where they've saved their money because the rent that they've been paying, the portion of their rent that they paid, went towards a savings account until it built up enough for them to be able to afford their down payment and closing costs towards affording a home. And then when they move into that home, they are paying, they continue to pay that balance, that amount that their voucher says they have to pay. And the program is paying the difference. And I believe that's for up to 10 years. And then in the interim, they're working with individuals to become employed in areas where they are gainfully employed and earning the living that they need in order to continue to be successful. But most of the persons that are 30 and 40% AMI, those are persons in the housing authority programs. A lot of persons that are private developers, it's just really difficult to get them to go that low, that far down.
So the majority of my people, I have half and half. I have a handful of people that are in that housing authority bit, but the rest of them aren't. They don't have a housing voucher, and they won't qualify to get one, but they don't make enough money. And they're seniors. They may or may not have Social Security. So it's still going to be like a chunk of people that won't even be able to be housed or be seen. There seems like there should be something that is already out here put in place for all the units that are already available that should open up to those people, because things that we see here and from your chart are only geared towards the 60 to 80 to 100.
You might want to, but you should have been at this morning's homeless meeting.
I'm just sharing what works for me here. I'm not in your areas. So I'm just sharing what we've been able to do here in Pinellas County that has helped us here. But certainly conversations and comments like what you just gave, which are very rich and certainly have shed a light on the areas where there are gaps for you guys, then that is something where anyone who may be a developer, your housing authority, and your municipal government, as well as your county government, should be able to come together to try to determine how can we best address this. Can we all partner together and begin to build and construct units for these people who don't fall into any one of the categories to be eligible to receive assistance? Because we do know that vouchers are limited, and we do know that, you know, seniors get their Social Security or maybe their retirement, and they may get a slight increase every year, but it's not a large increase. So that is certainly an area where all of those partners can come together and try to think about what works best for you all. I believe you're in Jacksonville. Is that correct?
Yes. So we actually have, I'm going to let Councilmember Boylan speak about that.
Can I interject very quickly?
Yes.
We have three working groups that are focusing on what we are calling the critical quality of life issues: access to health care, homelessness, and affordable housing. This particular group is affordable housing group. We had an extensive meeting, the fifth meeting, the homeless working group this morning, and I think we'll be pleased to see that we are looking at an eye towards creating a sustainable revenue source to support the homeless. And not just talking about shelters, we're talking about housing going forward. So I think this group will be seeing some action in that regard. So we're not discounting your comments, but we're really trying to keeping the two separate in terms of how we address them in the working groups. But they will be crossing points as we go forward.
Yeah. Thank you, Councilman Borland.
Thank you for your question.
Introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Carmel Oliver. Address is on file. I'm sorry. I was at the Jaguar game. One of the things I wanted to ask Commissioner Flowers, when you talk about rural communities, is tiny homes being targeted in rural communities in your area?
So far, no. As you well know, many of the persons who are finding difficulty with housing within Pinellas County, they live in the inner city.
Well, Ms. Flowers, I'm not really, I got multiple different number of questions because I'm trying to find out what best fits our community. And one thing that you highlighted for me as an individual is this half a penny sales tax.
Okay.
I don't know where my community sits, and we're trying to find more money that we can spend to provide more affordable housing and more economic development in some of our most impoverished communities. But I think this is about time. But also on top of that, I have another question. Have y'all taken a good look at a local housing voucher funding program? And also you mentioned something else when it comes down to y'all city reserves. How have y'all been able to help residents in your community when it comes down to rent and mortgage relief?
Well, in my presentation, I did share that we do have our rental assistance program where we do provide those funds through our community development block grant fund. I will get that information to Ms. Pittman. I don't want to tell a story and just throw a number off of my head and not tell you the truth. But it was sizable because we have a sizable population here of persons who are underserved as well as homeless. So I will be happy to get Ms. Pittman that information. I will tell you, for your question about the referendum, that's what we did here in our community. If that is something that you all desire to do, take your time in doing it. That's the advice I'm going to give you. Don't rush. Make sure you're doing all of your research, looking at your financial avenues, looking at the people who will support it in the community. Talk about it to a number of groups. Dot all your I's.
I just want to ask you just one thing. What did it take to get those developers in your community on board with another sales tax PIF? What was the benefit for them to give the stamp, rubber stamp of approval for?
The developers didn't give a rubber stamp. That's anybody who is a taxpayer. So it wasn't just developers. That referendum was on the ballot, and the voters within Pinellas County voted for that. So it's not just developers. It's anybody who pays taxes and who's a voter in Pinellas County. They got a chance to vote on that referendum item.
Well,
so it's not just the developers that control the area on that. Okay, I need you to wrap it up. Okay, I need you to wrap it up. Okay.
Thank you, Councilwoman Pitt.
Okay,
but Ms. Flowers, I'm trying to dig deep, trying to get a better feel of your community, so that we know what we're doing in our community, so we can get everything straightened out. My thing about it is that I would like to see in my community take a good look at a half a penny sales tax for affordable housing, the rental, tenant rental agreement, and on the floor of the legislature, try to break down that monopoly of citizens' insurance. I know you spoke of Daryl Rouse, and you need to bring in more competition into the state, but you mentioned something about infrastructure. And when you talk about infrastructure and septic tanks, how well have y'all been able to work on that?
Okay,
I think we've done a good job. It's a lot of money because stormwater sewer is not cheap.
Yeah.
I will tell you that the ARPA dollars that we received from the federal government allowed us to speed up our stormwater sewer projects so that we could put in place new septic lines, new stormwater sewer lines, provide some much needed repairs to our stormwater sewer treatment plants, and build onto our treatment plants, because we do have an increase in the number of citizens that are moving here. So of course we have an increase in our waste products. But just putting the dollars that we have to the best use and prioritizing those dollars. Sometimes, you know, people will get upset because maybe a sidewalk project was delayed, but we were able to enhance our water meters and our stormwater sewer piping so that people don't have all the leaks and so that we don't have the issues when we have heavy rains and it's stormwater intrusion and end up getting fined by the DEP. So it's not one particular issue or one particular answer. It's looking at scale of 1 to 10, what are our issues? And then of that 1 to 10, what are the top 3 pressing? And then what do we need to do or what can we do to help resolve those in a timely fashion? Some are going to be low-hanging fruit where you may have readily available financial resources, especially now with the administration we have in Washington, D.C. There are a lot of funding opportunities. You just have to apply for them to help you with your projects when it comes to transportation, when it comes to infrastructure, when it comes to housing. But you just have to apply for those. They are competitive.
No.
But you still have to apply to at least be in the game.
No.
So that's what I would do. Look at what are my top 10 most pressing issues. Of those top 10, let me narrow it down to 3 What funding sources does the county or the city have right now that can help those? And if they don't, what's out there available where we can get these things moving?
Well, Commissioner, thank you so much. Do we have any other questions in the audience? We really appreciate you bringing this home to us and some best practices that we can consider in our community. And I'm sure we'll be reaching back out to you. And thank you for stopping over in the parking lot to do your presentation.
I didn't want to be late. Unfortunately, traffic was not on my side today. The Florida Housing Coalition, also out of Tallahassee, has been very helpful and helping us to either marry some dollars, because they will put money into programs.
Yes.
You've got to put in some money too, but they put in millions of dollars in our programs here because they see that not only are we just providing them with a plan, but we execute that plan, it's completed, and we're moving bodies into those facilities. Can I just say something real quick about your homeless?
Yes,
ma'am. I was sharing with Ms. Pittman that we established our homeless concerns here in St. Pete were really bad. We established a what we call the Homeless Leadership Alliance. So instead of having just one place or one entity that's dealing with the homeless and there's no way they could make a real impact, we established the HLA, and it's all organizations that deal with homeless or transitional shelter or emergency housing. We all come together under one umbrella. We all got on the same technology system. We have one point of entry, so when a person is applying, they're not having to go to 15 different places for 15 different things. They come to one place, they put in their application, they describe what services they need. We have street outreach to go out every day into areas where we have heavy concentration, working with them if it's medicine, if it's getting them to housing, if it's reconnecting them with their families. Absolutely. Or whatever it is, we work through that system. So it's not one individual organization. It's all of the organizations coming together under one umbrella. What does it take? It takes people talking about we and not I.
Correct.
So, you know, everybody has to give up a little something at the table. But at the end of the day, it works better because you have not only our county, but our municipal governments that all give to that fund so that they have many more resources, particularly financial resources, to utilize, and they make a much greater impact in dealing with our homeless.
Well, again, thank you so much. I think you gave us a lot to think about in terms of best practices and initiatives that we can consider in Jacksonville. And Dr. Jaffe and I really appreciate you spending some time with us and now bringing it to a lot of the experts that we have in the room today. And I'm definitely coming down to visit you and see some of the
Please do. Just let me know when you're coming. I'll okay. set up the tour. We'll get one of our city vans that's electric because we move towards sustainability and resiliency. So I'll take you around. I'll show you those developments, the tiny home developments. We'll go by the PERC program. I'll take you to all of these so that you can see what it is that I've been saying today. It's better when you can visualize.
All right. Well, thank you so very much, and we appreciate you sharing with us here in Jacksonville. Take care. Thank you.
You are certainly welcome. And again, I apologize for doing it from the phone.
Just in time. Thank you.
All
Let's
right.
give
well,
her a round of applause, evening. Please.
Have a great evening.
All right, dear. Thank you. All right, Dr. Jaffe, it's all on you.
All right. Mercedes has distributed a document that lists the 10 preliminary recommendations. This is just the first cut. And these recommendations are based on the information we've obtained by the speakers, by the SWOT analysis, and some other investigative work I've been doing to try to think about how we can move forward on the issue of affordable housing in Jacksonville. These recommendations are not mutually exclusive. They're intertwined. To advance one often brings in another. And as you look through these, you can see that there are connections among them. I'm simply going to go through them very briefly. I've left a little space below each one if you want to take some notes, if you have some recommendations you would like to make to modify them, or if you have some suggestions for how we can actually advance these recommendations. I'd appreciate that, and you can return the document to me, and we can include that in our analysis. There are best practices and models related to every one of these recommendations. They are not listed here. I'm not going to spend time on them because that would take an enormous amount of the time we have today. But in the final report, there will be links to models and best practices around the country related to each one of these recommendations. So the first recommendation, I actually have the first two recommendations I regard as necessary conditions. That is, conditions that need to be in place if we're going to see any progress. And the emphasis here is on developing some kind of an administrative, cooperative, coordinated oversight of what is happening with affordable housing, bringing together the parties that should be working together. And I've mentioned just a few of them, Ability Housing, obviously Jacksonville Housing Authority, the Downtown Investment Authority, Habitat should be included as well. These organizations need to be brought together and working closely with the city, and the city should be supporting them in their efforts. And this is one way to have a group that can monitor the progress that we're making as we go forward. So I view that as a necessary condition for any kind of progress that would be made. The second necessary condition involves money. This has been discussed already. Renee Flowers discussed this issue as well. And the point is that the city needs to establish a dedicated source of funding that will be directed toward affordable housing, not pulled out of other sources or other areas of the budget that are inconsistent. So there's a whole range of ways in which cities, counties, communities have developed funding mechanisms. Some involve tax increment funding, linkage fees, and of course, a housing bond. One is currently being voted on in Palm Beach County. So there's a whole range of possibilities, but the point is this should be a priority for the city. Next, I would recommend, and I think this would be a good idea, is for the city to commission a study conducted by the Florida Housing Coalition. The Florida Housing Coalition has enormous levels of expertise. They can look at the recommendations that are made in the final report, they can confirm them, and they can also provide guidance on how to implement these various recommendations. I think the city has worked with the Florida Housing Coalition before. We had a speaker earlier at one of our, I think it was a second meeting, Michael Cheney, who provided us with some of the ways in which the Florida Housing Coalition believes we could be moving things forward. But I think they can also do a kind of deep dive research on exactly what the inventory of programs are currently in place and how some of those could be consolidated, as well as the best ways we can move forward with these recommendations. The fourth recommendation is inclusionary housing. This is something that's been discussed, and that is that builders and developers, particularly this is directed toward multifamily apartment complexes, would be either incentivized or required to put aside a certain number of units that would be available at affordable prices below what is referred to as a fair market rate. And there's a variety of ways that this can be done. In Atlanta right now, they're actually requiring this for all apartment house developers who are building within proximity adjacent to the Beltline. It's absolutely a requirement. There is no incentive involved. So it depends on the location. It depends on the type of housing. But this is obviously one area that the city should investigate. I should note that a few of these are prefaced with as recommended in the City of Jacksonville Comprehensive Plan 2030. If you go to the website for the comprehensive plan, you'll see that one of the documents is called housing units. There is a whole range of recommendations there. Many of them dovetail with exactly the kinds of things we think that should be done. They're in a document. I don't know who reads it. I don't know who pays attention to it. I don't think anyone is moving them forward, but I do like to preface some of our recommendations to indicate that these are already things that people have been identifying as critical recommendations that should be advanced in the city of Jacksonville. So the more we can get a consensus around what should be done and confirmation of these recommendations, the better. So I'm hoping that the Florida Housing Coalition can also help us with that. Okay, recommendation number 5 also has been discussed extensively, and that's inclusionary zoning. And this would mean addressing the issue of the large percentage of residential property in Jacksonville that is confined exclusively to single-family homes. This would involve loosening those restrictions, maybe targeting the removal of those restrictions in particular communities and areas, and that would expand what's called the missing middle housing, the housing between the single-family home and the large apartment complex. So this is also something that was recommended in the City of Jacksonville Comprehensive Plan of 2030. All right, recommendation number 6 is the acquisition of land. We have the Community Land Trust. This is a very, very important development. The city should be making a priority to provide the Community Land Trust with as much funding as possible. But in addition to that, and also recommended in the Comprehensive Plan, is the idea that the city, because it does an annual inventory of all of the properties available, city-owned surplus properties, there should be constant effort to utilize these properties for the purpose of building affordable housing. Recommendation number 7, something that's been discussed almost at every meeting, is the Tenants' Bill of Rights. The state of Florida is ranked 42nd in terms of the amount of legislation it has in place that actually addresses and protects the rights of tenants. So this is not a tenant-friendly state. And given what we know about the experiences of tenants in the city of Jacksonville, and we know that the Tenants' Bill of Rights has been passed in Miami, it has been passed in Pinellas County, it has been passed in Orlando in one form or another, this would be a document that would essentially put in writing and be required to be given to every tenant on the signing of a lease what their existing rights are, but also it's important to consider additional ordinances that would expand those rights given what we know about the abuse of tenants in Jacksonville. It also would involve, at least in the proposal we have, and hopefully this would be included, an office of tenant advocacy so that tenants would have a place to go to address their problems. All right, there's a lot to be said there, and we do have a document that's already been submitted on the Tenants' Bill of Rights, and hopefully that will be made available for people to see, and the City Council will take it seriously. Recommendation number 8, publicly owned nonprofit housing. In my view, and I think in the view of anybody studying the affordable housing issue, the market is not going to answer the problem. The market, to some extent, has created the problem. So we have to have a sufficient amount of publicly owned, nonprofit housing being built to accommodate the population and to address both low-income and middle-income residents. Today I was discussing this issue with a real estate officer in Maryland, it's Montgomery County, Maryland. I believe that they also spoke with representatives from the Jacksonville Housing Authority on what they have been doing in this area, and the key issue is how do you fund this? And so there are funding formulas that would be directed both to affordable housing generally, but also to the building of publicly owned nonprofit housing that would be far below fair market rate and would be competing with the private sector. Okay, recommendation number 9, monitoring, regulating institutional investors. I discussed this at the first meeting. We have currently, as many other communities have, a corporate landlord invasion. They're buying up single-family homes. They're converting to rental properties. They're raising the rents in order to provide a return to their investors. And let me just share a text I received today from one of these institutional investment firms. I go to their websites and I sign up, and then they send me information to try to attract my investment. And this one says, "Hello, hi there. In October, our average rent increase at lease renewal was 18%. Let's chat about how this affects your returns." So as long as we have housing that has been financialized in this way, we are going to be running into serious problems. In every community in the country, but particularly in the Sun Belt metropolitan areas, which are being hit seriously by this, they are trying to develop ways to address it. So I just mentioned a few here. One is ownership transparency. Quite often you don't even know who's buying these homes because they hide behind various bizarrely named LLCs. There could be limits on ownership concentration. There has been a proposal, a federal proposal in Congress for what is called real estate transfer taxes for every one of those purchases, and then using those taxes to support and fund affordable housing. And other administrative requirements probably should be put in place in order to de-incentivize the institutional investors, because right now Florida is a target, Jacksonville is a target, most of the major metropolitan areas in Florida are a target because we have very, very lax regulations and very weak protections for tenants. So administrative burdens wouldn't be a bad idea. Finally, we had a presentation by Jacksonville Area Legal Aid, and I think it's important that the city support the efforts of Jacksonville Area Legal Aid in the various programs that are designed to address the problem of evictions. Jacksonville has one of the highest eviction rates, if not the highest eviction rate in the state of Florida, and the work of the Jacksonville Area Legal Aid would dovetail with the kinds of resources that we would want to make available and that we would provide in a tenant's Bill of Rights. So that's a quick review of the 10 recommendations. At this point, if you have some comments, some thoughts, some questions, please share them. And why don't you come up here so you can use the microphone. This will be recorded. Thank you.
And 2 minutes, please, no more than that. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Angela McKee. My address is on file, and I represent the National Association of Residential Property Managers. Specifically, I represent owners who are local. We represent military families, small investors, accidental landlords. My concern as we're looking at this is that our brokerage that I represent is specifically about 350 properties. I work with about 70 to 80 other property managers throughout the city of Jacksonville, and most of us do service smaller owners. So some of these things that I'm looking at are going to impact them greatly. They're not people who have, they have mortgages. They're not paid off. They have to pay those mortgages, and they're not getting help from lenders. So when we look at eviction, we definitely want to help all involved. But I think we would be remiss if we didn't stop and think about these owners and making them a priority along with the tenants to work together.
Thank you.
Yes.
Introduce yourself.
Yeah, my name is Carnell. My address is on file. I'm just going to ask straight up, what is it that the nonprofits that represent affordable housing community want, and what is it the developers in this community want? We've got to come to a real agreement. It's about the money. Either we accept a tax increase in some kind of way or form, or we apply something that a gentleman came at another critical life meeting. It's about that dog. I support tenant bills of rights and all that, but what we have is that dollar being missed. All of this is fine and good what I see on paper, but it's about that money. Now, for all the Realtors Association that support this movement, that certain people from Florida Rising is from, and a number of different nonprofits that have organized this, y'all want to get that money in this community to help this community. So let's pull, let's quit hiding behind the curtain, let's be adults, and let's get this thing done. That's all it all boils down to. This is a shell game. Let's quit playing.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver.
Hey, I'm Christina Kittle, address on file, representing Florida Rising. Love that we had Commissioner Flowers on. Our colleagues in Pinellas County who have been pushing the Senate Bill of Rights have been working with her. So that was very cool to see and appreciate that. And I like that we're looking to other cities to see what works. Sometimes we get stuck in our bubble in Jacksonville and think that because it's always been a certain way, change is inherently bad, and that's not always the case. So I did bring copies of the Tenant Bill of Rights that was edited and drafted specifically for Jacksonville, because it is different than Pinellas, so there are some differences. So the only thing I'm going to say right now in limited time is just to do like a one-sentence recap of the 7 points that are in here so that people know what we're talking about when we say Tenants Bill of Rights. So the first point is the tenant, the Office of Tenant Advocacy, which we want to be fully funded and staffed office within the Jacksonville Housing Authority that exists to oversee the Tenants Bill of Rights, the Right to Counsel program. We were thinking about the JALA issues that are going on there and working with them to get that in there, and the Landlord Registry to receive complaints via a hotline. Number two is the Landlord Registry, a public searchable database of landlords who have been granted a license to rent in the city and the county of Duval. Licenses may be revoked if landlords are not in compliance with the Tenant Bill of Rights and other state and local laws. If they can look up our whole history and everything, and we have to pay fees for them to do that, that's a pretty fair trade, I think. Number three is the non-discrimination in rental application clause on the basis of gender identity or gender expression, sexual orientation, criminal record if a sentence has already been completed, and immigration status and source of income. Four is fee transparency, which requires all fees and fines, so not just the rent, but late fees, parking fees that you might have, trash fees, all of that, to just be transparent so that they know about it when they're signing the lease. Number five is expanded notice for changes to a rental lease or agreement. Give 90 days notice of termination of lease to leaseholders, 60 days if they're month to month. It also expands time of notice for rent increases that are going to be 5% or greater to 60 days,
thank
which goes
you,
back to point
Christina.
10.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And we'd love to have. No, we got to go. We got to go. If you could just leave a copy of that, I would really appreciate that.
Again,
thank you.
Just to reiterate what we said before, when the opportunity for comes that this recommendation is brought forward, that's when we'll do the deep dive into the tenants' bills of rights and the details thereof. I think a lot of these are great ideas. Today, really, it's just an opportunity to get the idea of a tenants' bill of rights on as a recommendation, and we'll follow up with the others once it gets introduced.
Absolutely.
Hi, my name is Maria Garcia. My address is on file, resident of the Brentwood neighborhood. And also just would like to say really quickly that I did enjoy having the council person from Pinellas. There is a theory of change table in Pinellas County that has been working very diligently to get, you know, housing relief passed, just like I'm representing the theory of change table here in Duval. So yes, just want to really reiterate how important it is to get this Tenant Bill of Rights passed, the expanded notice for changes to a rental lease or agreement that gives 90 days notice for termination is crucial for people to be able to find housing if they can't afford or they can't stay where they have been staying. The right to counsel is extremely important. As we know, the general public does not have right to counsel, and these, you know, landlords and leasing companies do have right to counsel, so we really need to even the playing field. and then the right to repair that would allow a tenant to make repairs and deduct from the cost of their rent if a landlord fails to make necessary repairs in a given time. If you'll recall, I gave testimony from a resident that rents from JWB Housing, which is has a large share of the rental housing here in Jacksonville and is ever growing, and they do not pay for the repairs that people need for housing that they're renting. And that's the whole point of renting, is that you shouldn't be held liable for the damages or maintenance on a property. So please, we really would like for someone here that's listened to all of this recommend the tenant bill of rights.
Again, the details will be in the devil, the details when the recommendation is introduced as a bill. And we'll go through it then.
Definitely. Michael Hodges.
I'm a little under weather, but I'm Michael Hodges. I'm representing NARPM, National Association of Residential Property Managers, and my address is at 10365 Hood Road South, Unit 205. I'm not going to spend a lot of time, because some of what we are talking about doesn't necessarily seem to go directly to affordable housing that's been brought up over the last few meetings. But I just want to let you know a few statistics on by Selman Associates. It's a national firm that does statistical sampling regarding lease renewals, regarding new leases. So they provided us 2019 statistics and also 2022, because I represent about 246 individual landlords. And most of our landlords in the 21 period, the 20 period, when all this stuff was going on, we didn't raise rents. We didn't raise rents. If we raised rents, it was very nominal. Might have been $25 a month. But not very much, okay? But 2019, the lease renewal rent growth was 3.1%. That's a lease renewal. Our average of our tenants stay with us for 4 years now. That's gone from 1.5 years to now 4 years, and they're staying longer. Now, they wouldn't be, they're staying with us because, number one, they're being treated properly. Number two, it's a good relationship, because one of the things that we, as landlords and representing landlords, we want our tenants to have a good experience. We want them to stay with us, all right? So we're not here to pop up rents 14, 20%. So when you're looking at all these statistics, some of what I hear is misinformation, and I don't want to get into specifics here, but some of what I hear is a lot of misinformation. But in 2022, the renewal rent growth was 7.4. Okay, and then the new lease rent growth was 4.4 in 2019, and in 2022, it was 11.8%. Okay, so some of the statistics are a little high. But those are just a couple things. The other thing that I want to leave you with is that we support rental assistance programs. We support a lot of those kind of things. And the other thing that we could do is do a lot of rezoning to make it from single-family home to multi-family.
All right, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Brian Alterman. Hi.
Hi, my name is Brian Alterman. I'm also representing part of a National Association of Residential Property Managers and landlords locally.
Can you come a little bit closer so we can hear you? Thank you.
For tenant benefits, but I'm also in opposition of rent control. While there may be a few bad apples who take advantage of tenants, that's not the majority. I think, as we all know, costs of everything are going up, and as a result, landlords are forced to take on losses of their properties due to the cost of owning properties going up, like home insurance for one. I know me personally, my homestead insurance went up 40% last year and 45% this year. Have a roof, plumbing, and AC and water heater that are less than 3 years old, no claims, but yet I have crazy increases. And if you're relying on rent to live your, not a lavish lifestyle, but pay for your family as expenses, maybe supplement your retirement, those crazy increases in expenses would obviously have an effect on that. And I feel like if you limit rents with the expenses increasing out of control rate, that really isn't the fault or the choice of the homeowner, but nevertheless, it's their responsibility to pay these. that you'll detract from people wanting to have rental properties in Jacksonville, and you'll decrease the supply of rental houses for Jacksonville renters. Not everybody wants to be a homeowner. Some people want to rent, and if you're decreasing that supply, it's only going to kind of hurt them more. And the last thing is that, I think we all know that rents have dramatically increased over the last couple of years, not just here, but across the country. And I think instead of, limiting on the investor side, some other ways that you can kind of combat that and curb that high increase on rental rates is to focus on the affordable housing options. Give more affordable housing options to people out there, kind of simple supply and demand. If you guys can increase the supply of affordable housing, then that might help the overall general good.
Okay. Thank you so much for your comment. Tia Vincent, did I pronounce that right, Tia? Okay.
Hello, my name is Tia Vincent. My address is 25 North Market Street, Unit 105, Jacksonville, Florida, 32225. I'm a broker and owner of Next Level Real Estate, and I'm a past and local Florida State President for the National Association for Residential Property Managers. I've been awarded the Northeast Florida Property Manager of the Year, and I currently hold positions with both the state, the local, and the National Association of Realtors. I'm representing accident landlords, absentee landlords, veteran landlords, elderly landlords that are living in assisted living, and investors with portfolios ranging from 1 to 25 homes. These homes are in Duval County, St. John's County, and Clay. I've managed over thousands of properties for landlords over the last two decades. I was here in 2006, 2007, 2008 during the housing market recession, watching those owners lose hundreds of thousands of dollars on the largest purchase of their lives, and then trying to pick it back up afterwards. And it seems that that's what we're kind of trying to do here. I've listened to the stories in the meetings before this about the different housing offerings and the horrible conditions that the tenants are being lived in. And I want to be very clear when I say this, and I think I can speak for others in this room, that I have never and I will never offer housing to someone in those conditions. The Landlord-Tenant Act is a lawful document that sets standards and habitabilities for maintenance standards. We stand here today discussing affordable housing, but the stories I'm hearing are not about affordable housing issues. I'm hearing quality issues, quality housing issues. Making homes cheaper won't make them fix the mold. It won't fix the roof leaks. It won't fix the AC units. In fact, making them cheaper, we had a tenant, I believe a couple weeks ago, say that she felt unsafe in the home that she was living in because she could hear her neighbors talking about her. But making the homes cheaper, statistics show that crime rates go up in areas that have cheaper housing. I manage homes through the eviction moratorium. These homeowners were fixing repairs even though they weren't able to get rents coming in. They couldn't evict for non-payment. They were still fixing those repairs.
2 minutes.
Is 2 minutes how? I thought I'm free.
She said two.
Okay.
Yeah, at her discretion.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Beth Mixon.
I'm Beth Mixon. I'm with Family Promise of Jacksonville. My address is on record. And I may have missed it, but one of the things that I would like for us to address is some of the here and now, the needs, where landlords are not accepting vouchers for families, veterans, senior citizens. While they have a voucher for housing, they cannot find a landlord that would accept those vouchers. Whether it's a financial incentive for the landlords, it's legislation that creates an opportunity for renters to find that housing, and also for us to address the practice of, in my view, what I consider predatory application fees and waitlist fees. Those are immediate needs that are facing our fellow citizens that I would like for us to address.
Thank you. Pierre, now Pierre, you're going to have to help me with this last name, so you come on up here and you pronounce it.
I'm Pierre Uimana. I'm from Florida Immigrant Coalition, and I am the state organizer for refugees, and I'm here to emphasize on the need of a tenant a bill of rights, especially on the non-discrimination issue, you know, inside. I have seen, immigrants and refugees coming here, and they get denied, you know, rental applications because they don't have credit history, but they have income, they are working. So I'm really concerned that if they cannot get accepted to, you know, to have rental properties because they don't have credit history, that's not fair for them. But if they can get evaluated based on their income, that would give them affordability to rental properties. So if that can be included in the Tenant Bill of Rights, that would be good for that particular community. Thank you,
Pierre. I have a special guest here today. First of all, I want to thank all of the public comments for today, and thank you for giving us. Oh, we got one more. Okay. Haven't you spoken?
Yes, so this is for public comment.
Okay. Come on, Angela. Come on. Got 3 whole minutes.
Two.
Got
to be fair.
Two. Yes, sir. I ain't going to give a three.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Angela McKee, address is on file. I actually prepared it so that I didn't fumble like I did earlier. Okay. I'm representing accidental landlords, absentee landlords, small investors, and the National Association of Property Residential Property Managers in Duval and the surrounding areas. I am proud to say that I earned my real estate associate's license in 2012, and I have served in volunteer positions ranging from a committee member to leadership with the Northeast Florida Association of Realtors and with the National Association of Residential Property Managers. I'm proud because I take the time to dive into, as these associations require, to teach us all about the rights. As a property manager, I was taught very early in my career the importance of the Florida Landlord-Tenant Act that we all must follow. Both tenant and landlords are held accountable in this legal document. It concerns me that as I hear many of the complaints about the quality of the dwellings that they've lived in, because as a property manager, this is not something that we would allow. So I really want to take a moment to focus on that as we're talking about the Tenants' Bill of Rights, is comparing that to what's already in place, because many of the things that we've covered here is covered under that. I'm immensely grateful to each city council member and the guest speakers that have taken their time to devote to addressing the workforce affordable housing issues. And I'd like to share that it is my opinion that one size does not fit all. I've had the honor of sitting in the homeless committees. I've served with City Rescue Mission for 16 years. So I've been in those meetings along with these. And many of the things that are being discussed in the homeless is about quality of life as well. And I really believe that, I'm sorry, I lost my place because it's hard
okay.
to make it to you. So, but I think I'm getting close on time. But I just want to say that there is a way to link those in order to work together to benefit Jacksonville and its residents, and also for the individual owners and investors that are looking to create an additional income for themselves.
Well, thank you so much. I just want to assure those of you all that had made public comment is that we are listening to you all, so don't feel that we're not. I think at the end of the day, even though this is our last meeting as the panel and as the affordable housing, I think most of the things that we've heard from you all, we have included it in a comprehensive plan for recommendation. And as you all know, this didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to take overnight for us to fix the problem. As I mentioned earlier, there's some low-hanging fruit that perhaps we can tackle, you know, along with some, as y'all know, at the end of the day, it's all about resources and policy and reform and how we can come together as a community, because I feel like we've had the experts in the rooms. not only our meetings, but in other meetings as well. And it's important. One thing I like about Jacksonville, if there's an issue, we know how to come together and get it done. It may not be in all of our times of serving or in administrative administration's time, but I think in developing a plan to go forward that we all can have a buy-in to. So I just want to assure you all being here tells us that you all are standing in the gaps for the people who are not able to come to all of our meetings. But I think we got you. We understand, and working with the regional council, we're going to get it right. As Dr. Jaffe said, we have many of studies, as you all know, sitting on the shelves. And now I think we're at a point that we want to implement. You know, we don't want to talk anymore. We don't want to do any more studies. And so you being here states that. But with that said, I'd like for Tom Dealey to come up and tell us some information that might be music to our ears. And while he's coming, those that have participated on our panels, would you please stand and let's give you all a round of applause for being here. Everyone that participated on panels, I just want to say thank you, and that also gives us an opportunity for options as we look at coming up with recommendations. Tom.
I guess Tom
Dale. I want you to be excited, right?
I'm Community Development for City of Jacksonville. And which
about the money?
$100 million. We're applying for $100 million worth of.
Say that one more time.
We're applying to the state for $100 million worth of productivity volume cap, which will allow the city of Jacksonville, in conjunction with Clay, Brevard, and Hillsborough County, to issue a single family mortgage revenue bond program, which would be for mortgages for households that are in 80% or below their median income to purchase a house. It's also coupled with down payment assistance that was originally, it's currently at $15,000 a household. They're considering upping that to $20,000 based on how the demand is. If they need to generate more demand, they'll increase the amount of down payment assistance. Now, not all of that $100 million will go for single family.
For real?
No.
Man.
Multi-family.
A lot of it will be converted to multifamily volume cap.
Okay.
That's what they've done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that is used to provide incentives for developers to build more affordable housing.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing. We're going to put it out in the atmosphere that we're going to get that money, right? Thank you.
Also, we were given $3.3 million for the additional ERAP 1 funds.
Oh, that's
real good. It's going to go on an emergency. One cycle emergency Wednesday night.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. As we wrap up, I know you have something you want to say.
I want to put Dwayne on the spot if I could for a second. Would you mind coming?
He's gonna be ready for you. You know, Dwayne always ready. Come on up, Dwayne.
Dwayne, I'd be curious to see. You heard your entity mentioned a couple of times in some of these recommendations. Could you talk about your comfort level? And you see this as an opportunity, I hope.
Yes, I actually think it's a good idea, especially I think it was recommendation number two, because doing some of the best practices, looking at some of the best practices, and looking at some of the studies being out there in the country. So let me back up a minute. So at the Housing Authority, it's about 4,000 housing authorities in the country, and I heard Commissioner
Flowers
talk about that the housing authority was losing some stock, which is totally true. And part of it is that the federal government hasn't been putting a whole lot of money in the capital fund money to be able to stabilize the existing housing stock. So you have that throughout the country, especially where you have a real big need for affordable housing. I think that the housing authorities now, they have to be a lot more creative, because when you look at the whole low-income housing, affordable housing, that came out of the incubator of the 1937 Housing Act, where the federal government was basically in charge of building low-income housing. Well, when you look at some of the most successful programs throughout the country, and some states, the state stepped in, or the city stepped in and provided money to the housing authorities. I'm not saying that you all should give all the money to the housing authority, but in most states, they gave the money to the housing authority, or they put had a revolving fund where they had it as a budget line item where it was funded on a yearly basis, and the proceeds from that actually went back into the fund. But it has to be something other than what currently exists. So I think many of the things that everyone talked about was very good. I think that I think we're on the right track. The only thing I would have a little concern with is that I did see that you list all of ability housing, which I have a great relationship with Shannon and Cindy. I think that when you have all of those different groups that provide affordable housing, it should be an allocation. If you put or place some funding in a line item for affordable housing, I think it would be best if you had a allocation for each one of those groups instead of being competitive, because if it's competitive, then whoever have the political connections will end up getting most of the money. It might not be the one that
do
the most work. Right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I appreciate taking a minute. Again, as you said, as I said, once these recommendations come forward, and I'm sure you and I and others will be making some resolutions and ordinances through this process, we'll have to get into, burrow into each of these recommendations, the ones that we move forward, mm-hmm. and have the kind of conversation about them in greater detail. Mm-hmm. But again, thank you both. I love the 10 recommendations. Mm-hmm. I think you're spot on as the direction you're taking us in this process. I think the input of this group was very helpful. You need to stay engaged in this process so we make sure that we move forward things that are balanced in what we do. So I appreciate the time.
Well, I just want to say thank you all again. It was my honor to bring the panelists to speak with you all today, and the support with Dr. Jaffe. He's done a lot of work. And you rolled out the work, and I really appreciate that. And as he said, we're going to stay engaged, and we're going to make some stuff happen that you're going to be proud of. Again, thank you also very much for participating in the affordable housing, workforce housing. Thanks. Thank you. Yeah, y'all can clap for us.